Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 10:44 a.m. and that is Friday, June 24th. And of course, being Friday, it's a big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I'm recording a little earlier because Mrs. Tracy bought me a tennis camp for Father's Day, so we're heading out this afternoon. Well, I thought we'd kick off with natural gas prices. Rallied really very impressively between February and earlier this month. Then in May, we had the first downside key reversal. Then we had another failed upside break in May. And then we had another downside key reversal in early June. And subsequent to that, prices have come back in a really dynamic manner. So if we zoom out a little, we can see that this area around $6 isn't just any level. It's the peak from back in September. It's approximating the region of the 200-day moving average. And then let's look at lots of back history and go back a decade, and we'll see that it's the upper side of the base formation. So this was the first time that natural gas prices had rallied without the aid of a hurricane. If we go back and think about the exceptional volatility we've had in natural gas in the run-up to the beginning of the shale revolution, every one of the big spikes was associated with damage to offshore production. So offshore production now is a lot less important than it was then, because all of the supply growth has been onshore domestic supply. And we had this big surge on the upside earlier on this year, but it wasn't in response to weather. It was because there's now export facilities. So we're seeing the globalization of the natural gas price. Now, natural gas is still traded in Asia on long-term contracts. There aren't any long-term contracts with Europe, which is a huge incentive for production in the USA to find its way to Europe and capture that arbitrage. But there was a fire in South Texas 2 weeks ago, and that knocked out about 50% of export capacity. So prices have come back in a dynamic manner. And this was obviously good news for inflationary pressures, for consumers of natural gas. But now there is the additional wrinkle. One of the biggest trends, and it's almost like a secular trend outside of the markets over the course of the last 20, 30 years, has been legalization. It's been a particular focus for the environmental movement. If they want to slow down the opening up of mines or the development of new mining operations or new fossil fuel operations or putting in pipelines, well, then they just resort to the courts and they attempt to ensure that the legal process stretches on for years at a time. And by sponsoring legal claims, then what they're in fact doing is bleeding the resources of companies trying to develop these assets, and then they just don't happen. So there's a big copper mine that could be built in Arizona, but it hasn't been. They've been wrangling about building this copper mine for 25 years, and they're not any closer to getting it done. So that's just one example of how this trend is slowing down the production of resources in North America. It's equally true in Europe. It's equally difficult to try and get these things done. And I saw an article earlier on this week. It was about whether it was worth sacrificing a flower for a mine. And there's a certain kind of flower that grows in Nevada in alkaline soils, and it's only flowers once a year. It's the only place in the world it grows, and it just happens to be in close proximity to a potential mining operation. And it's exactly this kind of moral, ethical environmental dilemma that tends to slow down the production of key resources. And this is now also relevant to natural gas. The Permian Basin stretches between North Texas, West Texas, and New Mexico. Well, in a Texas answer to a Texas problem is if you don't want to know what the ozone levels are, well, then just don't monitor it. But they do monitor ozone levels in New Mexico. And shale production releases ozone. So now the environmental lobby have been campaigning, and now they've successfully campaigned to the EPA. And it means that the cost of production for shale oil and gas is likely to increase because of the need to contain ozone. Now, that's laudable. Obviously, nobody wants to have greenhouse gas emissions, and everyone knows that ozone is problematic. But it's not exactly great for timing, and the price of natural gas is back at the first area of potential support. One of the biggest challenges in the market right now is that we're seeing prices move exceptionally quickly. Coming down by a third in little more than 2 weeks is an awfully big move. And we're starting to see support, or at least the first signs of support, coming through in the region of the 200-day moving average and the potential for a fundamental catalyst to support prices. And if it might be tenuous to say just yet that support has been found for natural gas, but West Texas Intermediate is up by nearly $4. And we've also seen oil prices pull back in a sharp manner over the last 2 weeks. So WTI bounced today from the $100 level, and that's at least near-term support. Now, we've definitely had more choppy action, and we have had big downward dynamics over the course of this year. And yet, prices still hold the sequence of higher reaction lows. So, I think it would be easy to conclude that this might be topping activity, but we're still in an environment that seems to be quite similar to what we saw between 2011 and 2014. There are fundamental factors that are helping to support the price, but then, of course, there are fundamental factors acting to inhibit additional growth price appreciation too. When we think then about just to split those out, in terms of supply, the million barrels a day from Libya have been knocked out of the market. Russian supply is falling because they don't have the materials and equipment necessary to sustain supply because of sanctions. So that's significant supply being taken out of the market. And now you have the threat of West Texas Intermediate supply starting to be curtailed as well because of environmental regulations. And those are significant supply. They're big enough supply worries to support the price. On the other side, we have the real threat of recession in Europe. The chances are they're already in recession. Slowing growth in China and slowing growth in the USA. So then that's implying that there'll be less demand. And of course, that's why we have this ranging environment. Supply and demand have come back into balance. But there's the potential that we're going to have supply shocks. We may also, of course, have a demand shock in the event that we get a deep recession. But at the moment, the challenge is that supply shocks are more likely, easier to rationalize and predict. What that at least suggests is that there is plenty of scope for oil prices to push back up towards the $120 area. And I think that is something that is rather interesting, because when we think about what's happening in the stock market, we've had a pretty impressive rebound in here today. The Nasdaq has gone from 11 to 12,000. So this isn't all that dissimilar from the rebound we had in May, where it went from about 11.5 to 13. We had a similar size 1500 point rally in February, where it goes from 13 to 14,000 and change, and in January from below 14,000 to just over 15,000. The outlier was the big rebound in March, where it tacked on 2,000 points. This is still a reasonably consistent downtrend, but we are seeing at least some buy the dip instinct coming back in because we're in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So that's the secular trend point. And one thing that investors are considering, at least, is that the Federal Reserve won't be able to raise rates because growth will deteriorate enough that they will be inhibited from raising rates aggressively. What the stock market's not pricing in is that if we do have a hit to growth, well, corporate earnings are also going to get hit. And then the PE ratio will go up and they'll start looking more expensive than they do right now. So what the stock market is betting on, if you're buying today with a medium-term horizon, you're betting that we're going to have the most benign Goldilocks scenario imaginable, that growth will moderate, interest rates will start to fall, and even though growth moderates, corporate profits will still be able to sustain peak levels from the post-pandemic period. And at least to me, that sounds like a stretch. It seems much more likely that we're going to have a volatile, rangy environment, and that being a best case scenario. So the Nasdaq has pulled back from about 17,000 to 11,000, and that's a sufficiently large pullback that we might see at least some pause and consolidation. The 200-day moving average is trending downwards. But then I think we can also think about the advanced decline line for the wider market. And when we put that up on a long-term trend, we can see that there's a deterioration underway, and there's a clear sequence of lower rally highs, and we're below the 200-day moving average. But it hasn't pulled back in as dynamic a manner as we saw in 2015. So it's been a broad-based decline, but it's not so deep that it can't be repaired. We can definitely see that in 2007, the average stock was declining, and it kept on declining all the way through until early 2009. We can also just, if we look at lots of back history, we can see that the advanced decline line does tend to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and we're still quite a ways from that level. So there is certainly the potential here that we might yet still be in a secular bull market, but that this corrective phase isn't quite over yet, and that we're going to be in a volatile, rangy environment for a while, and we might even see moves to new lows. And that, of course, is going to be dependent on both liquidity and then commodity prices. The two things that are the most reliable lead indicators for future recessions are monetary policy tightening and inverted yield curves, coupled with accelerations in energy prices, because energy prices are a tax on consumption. So we've had a big move in energy prices, and at least at the moment, it does not look like that is over. Now, we can also then think about what's happening in Europe, because that's where the most acute recession risk resides. So the DAX index pulled back violently 2 weeks ago from the region of the 200-day moving average. Now it's still above the low put in March, but it's not looking bullish either. So it's certainly got a lot of work to do. And I think it's also worth highlighting that this has been a choppy uptrend to begin with. It's not like prices for German equities haven't been rising over the course of the last 14 years, but they've been doing so in a really very choppy environment. But even then, if we take the outlier event of the pandemic out of the way, we still have evidence of support being found in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So it's trading below it right now, but because of the inconsistency of the trend, then we have to be willing to give it more room because it's done this before and rebounded. So if it's going to rebound again, well, then we're going to have to see a clear change of trend in terms of monetary policy and energy prices. So, if you look at UK natural gas, this is the FN1 commodity, it's pulled back violently and is beginning to demonstrate some support. And the UK has not got quite the same acute risk to Russian piped gas as Europe does. So it popped on the upside in the middle of the month, and then the price has been coming back down. Now let's look at Netherlands gas. So this is going to be a very different story. It helps to highlight that Europe is exceptionally exposed to Russia. Now, the Nord Stream pipeline has been shut down for maintenance, and it's due to open up again in about 10 days' time. So there is the fear in Germany that they might not open it up at all, and that instead of Europe becoming independent from Russian natural gas and stop importing natural gas by the end of the year, that Russia might simply decide to stop exporting now. This seems to be very similar to what people were castigating President Obama for in telling the Taliban what they were going to do in advance. So Europe has basically told Putin what they're going to do. They've said that they don't want to be importing any Russian gas by the end of this year. So by revealing their plans, he has a really strong incentive to just simply turn it off. And that is going to have a really significant impact on European growth, if in fact that's what happens. So the ECB is talking about raising rates, and the problem is that this is obviously going to have an inflationary outcome for Europe. And it's exceptionally likely that Germany will, having activated the level two of their natural gas crisis program in here this week, that they're just going to go straight to level three and nationalize the entire sector. Now, nationalize might be the wrong word. Government control might be another way of talking about it. But one way or another, they're going to have to start kicking off, opening up coal-fired power stations and doing so rather quickly. When we think about the outlook for the German utility sector. It's been a very difficult environment for the last decade. RWE peaked in 2008 and declined precipitously all the way through until 2015. They've had to close their coal-fired power stations. They've had to close their nuclear reactors, and they've had to invest heavily in renewables and in wind and solar. And it's definitely impacted the profitability of the company, but the share has been trending higher. Now, it broke out to new recovery highs earlier on this year. It's now in the region of the 200-day moving average. And they will have to start up their coal-fired power stations again. And The price is now pulling back once more. So the bigger question overall is whether they can avoid the negative impact of natural gas prices being exceptionally volatile. And that's a really problematic factor because what we've seen in the UK is that electricity prices are start have already risen, and large numbers of electricity traders went out of business. And it's increasingly likely that that same kind of outcome is what Germany has in store for it, that they are going to have to take over control of natural gas trading within the country. There will be rolling blackouts in the winter. It means that there's going to be a very cold environment in Europe this winter. Now, Germany has already been accused of being wishy-washy in their support for the Ukrainian resistance. And that's before we get into the winter season. So we're certainly in a more volatile environment. And surging energy prices are certainly a problematic factor, which could clearly contribute to both inflationary pressures and economic contraction, so that we head straight into a stagflationary environment. What's, I think, interesting here is that despite this threat in Europe, we're seeing more interest in the very speculative end of the technology sector. Now, part of the reason for that is because of the size of the decline. The ARK Innovation ETF has gone from 160 to 40. So a 75% decline in the space of 18 months is a really big move. And the share now is could rally 53% and would still only coincide with the region of the 200-day moving average. So I think when we think about how do these accelerated trends end, well, let's look at, for example, one of the shares that accelerated lower in 2008, Citigroup. So if we pull that up, we can see that, and just zoom in on this period between the decline in, or the low in September, or excuse me, February of 2009 was at 15. Over the next 3 months, the price rallied to 37. So anyone who was willing to buy in February doubled their money in 3 months. Now, subsequent to that, the price pulled back to 28, which was a meaningful pullback, and then really didn't go very much beyond that initial peak level for quite a long time afterwards. So after the crash, it is not unusual to see a really impressive short covering rally that doesn't come anywhere close to unwinding the extent of the decline, but certainly relative to the low, the absolute low level, it can be an impressive move. And we may be on the cusp of seeing something like that for some of these highly levered companies. So Zoom Media initially popped on the upside in here today. But when I think about what the possibility is, it would be easy to jump in on that assumption that we're going to have a short covering rally and that the low might be in. But we're not at a point yet where liquidity is increasing, and the threat from higher commodity prices, particularly energy prices, is still very relevant. And I think it is important to highlight that there is a big differential between the continued strength in oil prices and this steep decline that we've had in The copper price. Now it's off the low in here today because it got all the way down and touched the 1,000-day moving average. But this looks like a completing top formation, and there is clear potential that we're going to move into a much more volatile trading environment. And the LME Metals Index has also pulled back in an exceptionally violent manner. Now it's oversold, and that might mean that we get, for example, a reversion back towards the 200-day moving average. But the uptrend has been broken. The sequence of higher reaction lows has clearly been broken. Then we can think about some of the mining shares. So Glencore has, and a large number of the industrial metal miners have put in these downside key reversals and are back in the region of the 200-day moving average. So they're very exposed to the industrial metals complex. Anglo American continues to pull back, and it's now through the 200-day moving average. And BHP Billiton has also pulled back into the region of the 200-day moving average. So they're not quite yet responding to the weakness in the industrial metals complex, but if we see continued weakness in the metal prices, then they will follow on the downside. Now, EOG Resources pulled back exceptionally violently following the fire at the main facility it was pumping gas to for export, but it is now steadying in the region of the 200-day moving average. But the problem here is that the size of the downward dynamic will have chastened the bulls, and the momentum move is probably over. It's very much dependent on oil prices continuing to surge. And sorry, the Royal Dutch Shell have changed their ticker. Shell also pulled back violently and is now pausing in the region of the 200-day moving average. And again, very much attuned to whether we see a continued rebound in the energy price. Now, if we turn our attention to fixed income, because we've had this spectacular move in Treasury yields, and it's very tempting to think that the trend has been broken. We're in the region of the upper side of the base formation, and the move up to 3.5% has not been held. So we could potentially be looking at a failed upside break. Now, the yield has certainly bounced over this week from the 3% level, and the Federal Reserve is still due to raise rates, despite the fact that economic activity is moderating and the Purchasing Managers Index is likely to continue to decline. So I think these are important facts, that the growth in the economy is slowing. And obviously, inflationary pressures are very clearly influenced by commodity prices. But at the same time, how willing will they be to continue to raise rates into a declining economic environment? So, Jay Powell this week has been saying in plain English that they are thinking about reducing the size of the balance sheet by between $2 and $3 trillion. Now, between 2018 and 19, they took 750 billion out of circulation, and realistically, the process of quantitative tightening hasn't really begun yet. They only just begun to sell treasuries, and they're talking about bringing it down into the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And the way that they think about it is they think about it in terms of the relative to GDP. So we look at that. I think, and I will have to put an additional zero on this. I'm not entirely sure why it has changed from 3.6 to 36, but the shape of the pattern is quite is exactly the same. So the Fed's balance sheet relative to GDP, it should be 0.3. They want to get it down somewhere into this area. They want to unwind all of the move that has already occurred. So what he's basically talking about, it was right at the end of the testimony yesterday. He was answering questions from Representative Barr, and you can find it on C-SPAN. It was around the 2:44 to 2 hours and 44 minutes to 2 hours and 46 minutes point on that testimony. He basically said they want to take an extra $2 trillion off the size of the Fed's balance sheet. They're not going to sell mortgage bonds. So that's going to have a significant impact on liquidity. And it's going to lead to exceptionally tight financial conditions. And it also suggests that, and I think this is the primary point, that investors just don't believe it. They don't believe that the Federal Reserve has got the gumption to follow through. But financial conditions now are pretty close to back to where they were at the nadir in March of 2020. And they were also very tight in 2018. So we're coming back into this environment. Now, obviously, the kind of tight conditions that we had in 2008 are still a ways off. But it is worth also highlighting that financial conditions were significantly tighter all the way through the 1980s and 1990s. And it's really since 1998 that we've had very loose financial conditions, which has greatly helped to inflate asset prices for really just about everything. And I continue to see articles about how Rolex watches are a better investment overall than Bitcoin, or that collectibles generally are by far the most rewarding of investment opportunities. I had a conversation with somebody trying to sell shares or sell partial ownership in whiskey casks, and he was also quoting these very impressive long-term returns from buying whiskey when it's still in the cask, holding it for 10 years before bottling and selling it on. And I can understand the rationale for all of that. But the fact that these types of investment are now so clearly in the public domain and attempting to attract interest, it's very emblematic of the fact that we've been in an incredibly liquidity-rich environment. So the big question really is whether this very benign liquidity environment is going to persist. Central banks feel like they have to raise rates. They want to get in control of inflation. The only way that they can do that is to inhibit demand, because raising rates doesn't grow wheat faster. It doesn't create more ships. And it certainly doesn't stop wars. So, what it does do is it impedes the ability of the consumer to continue, so to buy things, and then it will also lead to higher unemployment. So we're in a really, I think, delicate environment. Many stock markets are back in the region of their 1,000-day moving averages. And this is a key point. It's where we would anticipate that demand should be coming back in. And there's certainly some evidence of buying the dip going on in the wider stock market. But one thing that I'm rather cautious of is that Bitcoin hasn't really rallied, and it's still pausing here in the region of the 20,000 level. We had an initial burst of enthusiasm for large cap NASDAQ shares in the morning, but Bitcoin is starting to ebb, and it is a very clear liquidity barometer. So if Bitcoin's not rallying in a dynamic manner, it is a suggestion that we should be cautious about betting that other liquidity barometers will also rebound in a dynamic manner. And I think it's definitely an indication that we need to be cautious about being overly bullish. Now, when we think about some of the more successful funds, well, Scottish Mortgage doesn't invest in mortgages. It's one of the it's been one of the ports of destination for technology investors in the UK. And the price has more than halved, and it's trading at a discount to NAV of over 14%. And that discount is similar to what we saw in 2002 through 2003. So, obviously, it's pulled back, and the value of the trust has probably pulled back more than its constituents. And then perhaps we should look at what they own, because it is beginning to stabilize, and it owns all of the big technology companies. Some of them are the big US ones, some the big Chinese ones, and some even the big European ones. So I'm going to put this window on one side, and let's just look for those share prices, because it's not inspiring. Zalando, for example, had a profit warning this week. So that share continues to pull back in a dynamic manner, and it's unwound more than all of the advance put in 2020. It's back in the region of the lows from 2018, but it's very oversold and was off the lows in here today. Moderna had once been by far the largest constituent of the biotech sector and then collapsed, but it's at least pausing here in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. ASML was considered for a long time to be a bulletproof stock that would never decline, and then came from 800, or I guess 750 and change, down to approximately 450, and it was in positive territory in here today. So bouncing from around the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So we're seeing that people still want to own these shares. Tesla has broken its downtrend, excuse me, broken its uptrend, but it was in positive territory today as well, bouncing from around the 600 level. Tencent has had incredible headwinds from the Chinese administration, but it's also steadying from above the 300 Hong Kong dollar level and testing the region of the 1,000-day and 200-day moving averages. Illumina is the global leader in producing genetic sequencing machines, and it has collapsed over the course of the last 12 months, but is also exceptionally oversold. And at what's I think particularly interesting, however, is that the PE is still very high, and when we think about the fact that the valuation has improved, but it's not exactly cheap on a price to sales ratio. It's a company that makes most of its money from service agreements. So the big sellout in the share is probably more to do with the fact that people are doing less testing for COVID than they were during 2021. Nvidia is also in the region of the 1,000-day moving average and beginning to steady. So when we look at all these charts, well, we can see that there's lots of shares are in the region of potential areas of support. And if you are an investor in the technology sector and you believe in the potential for technology companies to provide solutions to all of humanity's problems, well, then the buy the dip will certainly be coming back in here. But then the question has to be, where's the liquidity going to come from to fuel this advance? Because financial conditions are tighter and energy prices are potentially going to move up from here. And Bitcoin hasn't rallied. So we might see a short covering rally here for these companies that have pulled back in a violent manner, and then move into a lengthier period of ranging, because we just don't have the answer to where the liquidity is going to come from. Now, Japan has stated in very clear terms that they're not going to engage in quantitative tightening, and the yen remains weak, even though it's really oversold. We haven't had a break in the trend yet. The dollar index is pausing in the region of the upper side of its range. It was a little bit softer in here today, but again, we don't have clear evidence yet that this trend is over. But of course, it's also very clear that there is massive commonality between the performance of the dollar and the performance of treasury yields. So if yields come below 3%, it's very likely that the dollar will also roll over. And gold prices have been going sideways for the last month and are currently steady around the $1,800 level. If the dollar rolls over, then it will be a bullish catalyst for gold. The challenge for the gold market is that gold is susceptible to contagion selling, and it is a volatile instrument, and it surprises on the downside as much as it surprises on the upside. So it's rather important here that the succession of higher reaction lows continues to be sustained. When we think about what's likely, well, one thing that has to be considered is that Europe has gone the same way as Japan. They're having exceptional difficulty raising rates. They are probably going to raise rates by 25 basis points in July, and then they're going to have to try and do something to curtail the widening spreads between peripheral debt and German debt. The pullback we saw on the Italian spread has not followed through on the downside. So it looks increasingly likely that bond investors will attempt to test the resolve of the ECB. Then, when we think about the US curve, the 3-month yield is steadying from the 1.5% level. The Fed funds rate is at 1.75%, and the Federal Reserve has said in plain English that they're going to raise rates to 3% by the end of the year. So if bond yields at the long end of the curve come down, then the artificial demand for bonds at the short end and near cash items will dissipate, because people will start buying the dip on the long end because they're worried about deflation, and they'll start shorting the short end, or they'll start just simply selling out of the short end because of the risk of imminent interest rate hikes. So that is likely to contribute to the 10-year minus the 3-month spread continuing to contract. It's come in by really rather a significant number, going from 230 to 149 basis points in the space of 6 weeks. And it's pressuring the sequence of higher reaction lows, but it is below the 200-day moving average. And it's likely that if, as we move progressively towards a recession, that this spread is going to continue to contract. So it's certainly going to be problematic for the financial sector. So there's obviously a lot of challenges in terms of growth. There's short-term potential that some of the technology shares can rebound here, but their ability to persist in rebounding will be very much dependent on central banks doing an about-face, worrying more about deflation than inflation, and flooding the market with liquidity. It's not an inconceivable potential outcome, because every time the size of the Fed or the ECB's balance sheet has contracted, they have had to double the size of that balance sheet to try and correct the deflationary forces. So quantitative tightening has only really just begun. And when they've gone through that process, the deflationary forces unleashed will probably result in them having to make a massive infusion of new liquidity later. But we're just not there yet. And the rising price of energy is certainly problematic. And it implies that buying the dip is probably more of a trader rather than an investor's attitude right now. And that investors would be probably well advised to look at valuations, look at value. And we're also seeing that defensive sectors are beginning to attract interest. So if we look at the defensive funds, they tend at least to attract interest right at the end of a bull market. When defensive stocks do best is right before a recession. So we're starting to see things accelerate in terms of the cyclical things we see towards the end of an economic expansion are all falling into place. We've had a big move in energy prices. We've had a really strong, impressive advance by commodities. Now we're starting to see increasing demand for defensive shares. Defensive shares are generally the ones that peak last. So this is certainly pointing increasingly towards recessions. And we will anticipate that stock markets will probably bottom before the recession ends, but they're unlikely to bottom before the recession begins. So it's certainly a time still for more caution than risk-taking overall. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.